KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to The Business. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today aren't just on the big screen. They can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate tales and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the globe. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, there are places in the TV series that seem to have been fished straight out of my dreams. It's quite uncanny.
Hilary Mantel had many suitors for the rights to her award-winning novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. The winning pitch came from producer Colin Callender. And the Wolf Hall miniseries, already a big hit on the BBC, is now on PBS. Mantel and Callender tell us about adapting a novel set in the 16th century for 21st century television. But first on the News Banter, a new host for The Daily Show, and a major defection of agents and clients from CAA. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So, Michael, Trevor Noah. Trevor Noah named, and I wasn't entirely shocked. I caught him on The Daily Show. I thought, this is a guy who feels to me like he could potentially be in their minds as a replacement for Jon Stewart. Sure enough, they announce him, and then 20 seconds later, social media jumps on this guy big way.
Yeah, you know, critics, fans, people are mostly hailing the choice. It seemed like an inspired, different, unique, original choice. And then you're right. Suddenly everyone started combing through his social media and looking at tweets that he had done back in 2012 and found them rather offensive to women, to Jews, and also just plainly not funny. And so that's bringing up questions on, did Comedy Central really vet him? And was this a mistake?
Yes, one of our colleagues called it a Sarah Palin situation where with the improper vetting. Who knows? I mean, Trevor Noah is a very handsome young man from South Africa. Seems to be an educated guy, speaks a bunch of languages. These jokes didn't land. And I guess the real question is, do you cut a comic a break, as some people have argued, and say, well, you know, you can't hold a few tweets against him. In fact, that's what he argued and Comedy Central argued. Or do you say these are offensive, the end, and not funny, even worse? And what happens? I think it looks, from where I'm sitting right now, it looks like he can survive. What do you think,
yeah,
Michael?
Yeah, and it's still several months away before he even takes over. So, you know, it's probably for the best that this all came out now because, by the time he actually takes over, it'll kind of be long forgotten. And as long as he continues to do great work on The Daily Show right now and really open strong, then I think we can all move on. We're not talking about another Brian Williams situation.
It's going to be fascinating. It would be fascinating to be a fly on the wall and hear the councils of war and how Jon Stewart is analyzing this and whether he totally backs this guy, whether he knew about these jokes, you know, and how they're going to go about trying to make him work as a host for The Daily Show in time for Democalypse 2016.
Yeah, my main other concern is how educated is Trevor Noah on the American political system and will he feel like he can speak from authority or from on high when the election comes?
Yeah, we will wait and see how that goes. That will certainly be an interesting behind-the-scenes show in and of itself. Meanwhile, speaking of behind-the-scenes shows, the councils of war at CAA following a huge defection. And this is CAA, no longer the biggest agency since William Morris Endeavor acquired IMG, the sports entity, but definitely probably, I would say, the most feared in some ways. You know, the nickname is the Death Star. They've got that crazy-looking building in Century City that looks like the Death Star. And this couple of agents, it's very strong comedy agents, Jason Heyman and Martin Lisak, left for UTA, United Talent, where they had been before, and a big blow to CAA, both in terms of clients and perception.
Yeah, I mean, 10 agents at the time of taping and probably more to come down the road. But the fact that they brought with them high-powered clients like Chris Pratt, one of the biggest movie stars in the world right now, and Will Ferrell, of course, and Melissa McCarthy, and the list goes on. This is a big deal. And for UTA to come in and steal these clients away, we've seen agents defect before to create new agencies, but it's been a long time since we've seen so many actually hop from one to another at this capacity.
Yes. I mean, CAA itself was created in 1975 when a group defected from William Morris at the time. So that's how that started. But boy, for a long time, Mike Ovitz, who ran CAA, would made it clear that he would just destroy anyone who tried to defect from CAA. It was a huge deal when there was one minor defection at one point. This does, you know, I mean, an agency is based partly on the faith that the clients have in the strength of the agency. And so this doesn't help CAA. They're trying to act like, you know, we can survive this. It's not that big of a deal. And they still are a big agency. But again, the perception is critical.
Yeah, and a lot of this, Kim, comes down to money and the fact that you know, both CAA and WME are now flush with private equity money. And these are different companies than they used to be. They don't want to just be agencies anymore, but that's causing some strife internally.
Yeah, because some of these younger guys saw the senior level partners getting fabulously wealthy. They don't see that necessarily as an option for themselves anymore. And who knows what UTA offered to get them there, but I'm sure it was plenty. And this is a sign of upheaval in this industry. There's a lot of change going on, and something like this is being greeted as a gigantic deal with these huge clients, making UTA a powerhouse in comedy.
Absolutely. And so next up, the big question is, how does CAA respond? They've already hired a bunch of high-profile lawyers, and they've got a number of options. Maybe they steal away agents from other agencies. Maybe they steal away clients, or they just paper UTA with lawsuits.
Yeah, they could sue. I mean, I think that the law is a little murky. They're saying some of these agents were under contract. It's not clear how enforceable that is. So eventually they probably sit down and divide up commissions that are due from these clients. And if it's a Melissa McCarthy, that could be Chris Pratt, that could be a whole lot of money. But definitely this is perceived as a state of war. Meanwhile, going back to a story we've talked about in the past, there was a lot of doubt when the Chinese company Huai Brothers said they were going to invest in, at first, an unnamed American studio, which quickly was revealed to be this company called STX, which was founded by this guy, Robert Simons, who is a producer who worked for a long time with Adam Sandler. But that money appears to be real, and STX looks poised to just spend a fortune on movies in the next few years.
Yeah, the numbers, Kim, are astounding. So they'll spend $750 million this year, followed by $950 million in 2016 and over $1 billion in 2017, according to Simons. That's money that you can't sneeze at.
They're talking about making a lot of movies in this mid-budget range, which has been largely abandoned by the big studios. You know, they're booking Marvel movies into 2027. And this space of $30 to $80 million movies has been left. You know, the studios got big overheads. They want to make a lot of money off of every single movie. So they've sort of not been so interested. Even if these smaller movies are profitable, it's not profitable enough for them. The thing is, you know, it's risky too. You can lose a lot of money on a mid-budget movie. And when you're making this many of them, you sort of say, can you really maintain a standard when you're doing this?
Well, the hope is that you run into, say, an American Sniper or a 50 Shades of Grey, a mid-level movie that does hit it big at the box office. And of course, then that covers all the failure.
I mean, one of the things that has people skeptical in Hollywood is that the people running this company are people who did not necessarily succeed in their jobs at other studios. That doesn't mean that they obviously did rise to high-level jobs at other studios on the strength of something. So the question is whether these guys can pull that 50 Shades of Grey rabbit out of their hats, you know?
Well, the one thing they may have going for them is that they're not trying to cater to the China market, which is often what we see with Chinese companies coming in and spending money in Hollywood. In this case, these are movies that still seem very much tailored to the U.S. box office. So who knows? That could come up with something.
The Chinese have been really cautious, including this company, which was said to be in talks that fell apart with other filmmakers. They've been very, very careful. So, of course, it will be interesting to see if they made a good bet with this one. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine. Author Hilary Mantel's historical novels, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, made her the first woman to win two Man Booker Prizes. Both books chart the life of English statesman Thomas Cromwell, who rose from humble beginnings to serve as right-hand man to Henry VIII. That job was fraught with danger given the intrigue in the king's court and the king's capricious personality. We are in the throes of Wolf Hall Mania here in the States. A two-part, six-hour stage adaptation of Mantell's books just opened on Broadway. And now a television miniseries that already won rave reviews in the UK is having its bow on PBS. Veteran British stage actor Mark Rylance plays Cromwell, who begins the saga working as counsel to Cardinal Wolsey, the King's Lord Chancellor, played by Jonathan Pryce. Cromwell appears unassuming, but he's got tricks up his sleeve, including an actual card trick.
God, where did you learn this?
At the docks, a little after I left home. Earned a living from it for a while. Everyone thought they could beat a child.
What else should I know about you? Monstrous servant.
Today we're joined by Hilary Mantel and Colin Callender, the producer who brought Cromwell's saga to television. For almost 20 years, Callender was president of HBO Films, where he oversaw award-winning projects like John Adams, Angels in America, and Recount. Now he runs his own production company, Playground. Callender was interested in adapting Wolf Hall from the moment he picked up Mantell's book.
I was captivated by how Hilary had taken a period of history that we've seen on screen before, but gave us a completely fresh perspective. And she took a character who is normally portrayed as a sort of two-dimensional villain lurking in the wings, and she took this character, Thomas Cromwell, and put him center stage and turned him into an extraordinarily complex and enigmatic and interesting man. And I thought that in a sort of post-Sopranos, post-Breaking Bad world, in a universe where the audience has embraced Walter White and Frank Underwood and characters like that, I thought we had in Thomas Cromwell an extraordinarily interesting and complex character that was very modern and would speak to a contemporary audience, even though it was a story of 500 years ago.
Now, Hilary, had others come to you asking to adapt this as a film before you met Colin?
Oh, yes. There were many suitors, but it seemed to me that television as a medium would serve this better because it's a swirl of complex events which in lesser hands could get lost or they could get caricatured. The length of a feature film only allows so much exploration. I really believe that this was the best way to go. It's always a leap of faith, but I'm not someone who's very defensive about my work. What I'm looking for is an enhancement of the material and, quite incidentally, an enhancement of my creativity. I don't want to hang over a project, but I want to be there if I can help in any way. That means finding people who are sympathetic to the way you work and who will not try to completely cut you out of the process, know how to consult, know how a writer works.
Colin did one of my favorite things ever, which is the Nicholas Nickleby. It's a very lengthy, you know, stage production based on the Dickens novel, and then Colin made it into this fantastic production on screen. And I don't know if that was influential or you'd never even heard of it.
Oh, I had indeed, yes. And do you know, it was the series John Adams that...
Oh, yes, that's another one
really,
of my absolute favourites, too.
Really did it for
too.
Me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I thought that was made with such integrity that it was the best historical drama I'd ever seen. And I found it really exciting because I thought, this is where we're aiming.
Colin comes to you. You talk about this John Adams miniseries. How involved were you? Did you get a commitment? Like, I want a written commitment that I will not be cut out of this thing?
Oh, no, nothing like that. If you're doing business with civilized people, the whole essence of it is you're trying to bring out the best from each other. And I knew that nothing like that would happen. We're grown-ups. The difficulty for the writer of the original material is always to find that balance. What distance do you keep? In a sense, you have to be invited in, but you have to show that you're worth being invited in, because you have to be flexible in your ideas. And for me, the process of adaptation into another medium, it isn't about reducing the original work or cutting away. It's about drawing the potential out of it. Because when I write, I'm always thinking, well, I have a soundtrack and I have a cinema. I have a film running in my head. And sometimes you say to yourself, this doesn't work on the page, but I know exactly how I'd do it if it were a film. So my viewpoint is, take advantage of the privileges you are offered to rethink the story, draw out potential from it.
But I think that, you know, sitting on the other side of the table as the putative producer of the television adaptation, I think what one does is say, what's right at the heart of the book? Why has the reader been so engaged by this story? And I think that what we certainly tried to do was be faithful and pay and be constantly guided by the central ideas of the book. So, for example, when we came to shoot the series, Peter Kuzminski, the director, shot the series handheld, and the camera is sort of follows Thomas Cromwell wherever he goes. And it's not shot in a sort of stately, traditional way in which you might shoot a historical drama. It's got that sense of danger about the world that makes you sit at the edge of your seat.
It's a conjuring trick, if you like. There's a point where, in any creative work, the viewer or the reader makes a commitment because they have faith in the person who's showing that to them.
I don't know how much of the Cromwell story, he's been reappraised really and partly because of your book, I imagine, but how much do you know and how much do you imagine?
Thomas Cromwell's public life from his 40s onwards is extraordinarily well documented, but his birth was obscure. He was a blacksmith's son. Nobody took any particular note of him. We don't know how, where he was educated. There is a part of his life which is myth, and then there is a part of his life which is cold, sober fact. So what you do is take creative advantage of that. You use every fact that can be known. Where the facts run out, you begin to imagine. And you reconstruct, but in my case, carefully and soberly, on the basis of what we do know. So that I believe I have a starting point for every speculation. Now, the unknown portion of the known life is very fascinating. It's like the dark side of the moon. And there is a reappraisal. There is a lot more work going forward. You know, there are fashions in history, like everything else. And Cromwell hasn't been in fashion since the 1970s. Now he's back. And, you know, you're happy to be part of it. It's not the whole of your venture.
But what you wanted it to be very authentic in the setting of the 60s.
Indeed. To me, it's not worth doing unless you research as well as you are able.
Yes. How difficult was it, Colin, to create that? You're trying to make it, you know, the lighting look 16th century dark, you know, and that sort of thing.
Well, you know, all the nighttime scenes are shot with candles, with no electric light at all. I mean, one of the great joys of the new sort of equipment that the new cameras that are out there is that you can work in much lower light. And as a consequence, because we were shooting in buildings of the period, there were no sets built. It was 85 days entirely on location. Because we were shooting in places where, in some cases, the characters in the story had actually walked themselves, there was a sort of sense of being there that I think you get as you watch it that is unusual.
Coming up after a short break, Hilary Mantel and Colin Callender explain why they turned to a director known for documentaries and an actor known for stage work to bring Wolf Hall to life on television. Plus, an update on the third book in Mantel's series. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to author Hilary Mantel and producer Colin Callender about the making of the miniseries Wolf Hall. The TV adaptation of Mantel's award-winning novels was a critical and ratings hit on BBC Two in Britain and debuts now in the States on PBS. The series follows the rise of Thomas Cromwell, the lawyer of lowly birth who worked his way up to chief minister to King Henry VIII. At this pivotal moment in history, the king was seeking to annul his marriage to his first wife, Catherine, so he could marry Anne Boleyn. To pull off this feat, Henry broke away from the Catholic Church and declared himself head of the Church of England. Henry was not happy when his plan met with opposition from his staunchly Catholic advisor, Thomas More. In Wolf Hall, Cromwell, played by Mark Rylance, counsels the king to proceed with caution, but the king, played by Damian Lewis, has other ideas.
This business of Thomas More, I don't doubt his loyalty to Rome, nor his hatred of your majesty's title as head of the church. However, legally, our case is slender. It won't be easy.
Do I keep you for what's easy? Do you think I've promoted you for the charm of your presence? I keep you because you are a serpent. Do not be a viper in my bosom. You know my decision. Execute it.
Historical authenticity in Wolf Hall was extremely important to both author Hilary Mantel and producer Colin Callender. But Mantel says when it came to casting, a physical resemblance to the real characters being portrayed was only a partial consideration.
To look at it from my point of view, just to take Cromwell, for example, there are two sources of evidence as to what he was like. One is Holbein's rather dour, stolid portrait of a man who seems not particularly pleasant. And then there are descriptions by contemporaries of the impressions Cromwell made on them, which are almost the opposite. As someone nimble in conversation, quick-witted, charming, and the kind of man people really like to talk to until they realise they've said too much. And trying to reconcile those two things is a very interesting creative endeavour. There are some quite big players in history of whom no portrait survives. So you recreate them in your mind as an energy. And if the energy is right, then the build, the height, the physical features of the actor who embodies them matter less than you think.
And in the case of Mark Rylance, he isn't the sort of physically bulky man that
Yeah, he seems to be quite a bit smaller than Cromwell would have
but
been.
But on the other hand, I think as you watch Mark Rylance as Cromwell through the course of the 6 hours, you see him change physically. But it's not because he's actually physically changing. It's because his whole presence and the way Mark Rylance inhabits the role. So I think it is very much to do with this idea of the aura created. And the same is true of Henry VIII, Damian Lewis, and Claire Foy's Anne Boleyn. What was interesting about Mark in particular was that although he was very well known on the stage, he isn't known to the television audience. And I thought that that was potentially an enormous asset because he didn't bring any baggage to the role, quite aside from Mark Rylance's inherent abilities as an actor and being absolutely right for the role.
First of all, it was a very big success in Britain, the biggest ratings on BBC Two for a drama since ratings began, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you expect that? And how important going in were you thinking about, was it to think of the United States and the response in the United States? Was it important at all?
Well, when I read the book initially, my first thought was this will be enormous in America. Because oddly, I felt that the landscape had been sort of prepared for us by other historical dramas, even the series The Tudors, because I thought that what we would be able to do with Wolf Hall is blast an Exocet missile through that, completely turn the world upside down and take a world that the audience thought they knew and give them this complex portrait and surprise them. That said, I don't think any of us expected the sort of response in advance that the show got and then when the show went on air. I mean, I think it's frankly an enormous tribute to Hillary's storytelling, that there's something about what Hillary did in telling this story that has really struck a chord.
But let's not forget the wonderful contribution of our screenwriter and director, because they were the dream team.
I tell you what, Peter Kosminski...
He was known mostly for, like, documentaries and political...
Well, that's why he was such a wonderful choice for this. He brought a documentarian's eye to this, as well as a dramatist's eye. And Peter Strawn was a film writer. He hadn't written any television. The thing he had done just before this was the adaptation of the John le Carré Tinker Tailor. He took a theme that was in the body of Hillary's 1,000 pages, the story of Thomas Cromwell seeking revenge against those that brought down his mentor, Cardinal Wolsey. And he used that as the motor and as the spine to drive the 6 hours.
And he did it extremely skillfully and with great flair. And an instinct for the politics as well and for the era. And for me, it was the best possible team. When Peter Kosminski came to see me originally, I said to him, do you know, when I see this book in my head, I see the shake of the handheld camera. Of course, I had no idea at that stage what Peter was planning. I wondered why his face lit up, but it seemed an extraordinary meeting of imaginations. You know, there are places in the TV series that seem to have been fished straight out of my dreams. It's quite uncanny.
I guess I should say spoiler alert, but something bad happens to our hero, our anti-hero. And where are we with the third book?
The third book is called The Mirror and the Light, and it explores the last 4 years of Thomas Cromwell's life. It's not a story of his fall. It's a story of his rise and rise. He becomes Earl of Essex, the most powerful man in England after the king. And then his sudden fall, and he dies on the scaffold at the hands of the headsman, as so many people close to Henry. That was the end ahead of them, but he didn't know it was ahead of him. And, you know, this is so important. They're walking forward through their lives. They're not looking backwards.
But are you finding time with all that you're doing? Are you writing this?
I would imagine. I write all the time, but I don't write chronologically, and I don't write sequentially. So I cannot say I am up to the year 1538. We have two more years to go.
And
I'm not quite sure how much time I need to complete the project. I only know I shan't skimp it. I shan't scant it. I won't disappoint my readers' expectations or my own. But I'm more fascinated by the material than I was at the start. And partly that is because of the TV series, because of the plays, because I have these people to co-imagine. But of course, when an adaptation is made, usually the primary source material is done. It's done and dusted. It's cut and dried. Not so in this case. There are areas I'm still exploring. It may be that things that we thought we knew about Cromwell from the first two books, we don't know. As I say at one point in Wolf Hall, beneath every history, another history.
Mm. Now, Colin, what's the plan vis-a-vis future?
Everyone is ready, willing, and able. And as soon as Hillary delivers the book, we're all going to jump right back in.
Colin Callender and Hilary Mantel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Melissa Morton. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.